This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in October of last year.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. With their towering cinnamon-colored trunks and dusky green canopies, Ponderosa Pine has long been a charismatic icon of the American West. Yet a quiet unraveling has begun. In the past decade, in a vast area from Santa Fe to the Sierras, more than 200 million ponderosa have died. While some trees will survive in cooler places, scientists estimate that by the mid-century, less than 5% of the ponderosa in the American Southwest may remain. As the very character of this vast region shifts, what will be left behind, and how can we come to terms with such profound loss? We'll be talking with the writer Gary Ferguson about his new book, The Twilight Forest. Gary Ferguson has written for a variety of national publications, including Vanity Fair and Outside. He's the author of 27 books on nature and science. His memoir, The Carry Home, was awarded Best Nature Book of the Year by the Sigurd Olson Environmental Institute. Hawk's Rest was the first title to win Best Book Award for both Mountains and Plains and Pacific Northwest Booksellers Associations. Decade of the Wolf, written with Yellowstone Wolf Project Director Doug Smith, was Montana Book of the Year. Many other books as well. Gary Ferguson, such a pleasure to talk to you again.
Thank you. It's great to see you again, Tom.
Good to be with you. Are you still in Montana?
Some of the time, doing some retreats and workshops and so forth, but I'm in Portland right now, and soon I will be for many months in the winter in Tucson. So I'm a hard guy to pin down, as is my wife Mary, so we keep it rolling.
All right. And you guys are still doing deep ecology?
Yes, full
Your
ecology.
Project? Yes. Full ecology, yes.
We are, and it seems like the time is right. For those who don't know, my wife is a very accomplished social scientist, and we put together a program that really basically helps people learn to use nature itself as a guide for kind of knocking down the wall that most of us have built between the human psyche and the natural world. And we're very excited 10 years out about the work.
FullEcology.com to find that project. So the Ponderosa Pine, why this book?
Lots of reasons. I love Ponderosa Pine since I was a kid growing up in the topographically challenged region of northern Indiana, where everything was flat and laid out to the cardinal points of a compass. When I first saw Bonanza on television and the Cartwright sitting horseback against a forest of Ponderosa Pine at the edge of Lake Tahoe, I fell in love with that tree and knew I wanted to know more and spend more time with it. And then practically once I did move west, and it took me little time to do that, many, many times when I was out for weeks at a time under a backpack and the weather turned foul and I needed to seek shelter, a lot of times it happened that the Ponderosa Forest sheltered me and provided that security for me. And then finally, I'd say, for whatever reason, when I suffered some very big losses in my life, my father dying early, my mom dying early, my first wife dying in a canoeing accident just past her 50th birthday, I went to the Ponderosa Forest to heal. And you mentioned their towering cinnamon trunks, and you know they have this beautiful perfume of vanilla and butterscotch. They're spacious. A lot of the early explorers commented how amazing it was. They could ride their horses at full gallop through a mature Ponderosa forest or even drive a box wagon through. So you get in there and it's, Tom, I think the equivalent of a golden lab waiting on the porch after you've had a bad day at work and you're finally home again. It's a friendly forest and it puts its arms around you. And so for all those reasons, I had a personal stake in it. And then also, I do think that the unraveling of the Ponderosa Forest in the Southwest is actually creating what I would call the first post-climate change landscape in America. It's going to be a profoundly different landscape where forests are going to be, and not everywhere, but in many places, they'll be replaced by permanent grasslands. And that's a big deal.
You talk about the shade of a Ponderosa forest, not too much, not too little.
Yeah, it's almost like strong candlelight instead of sun. So it's never gloomy. These are not the forests of Little Red Riding Hood where there are fiends waiting around the trees and witches to get, put their evil spells on. This is really a welcoming forest. In some ways, it reminds me of what I've seen in Africa, and what a lot of anthropologists talk about is how when humans first started walking full time upright, they were in these kind of forest fringes on the edge of large grassy areas. And Ponderosa is sort of that forest. So in some ways, perhaps it became so iconic in art and movies and in my life, maybe because it's just genetic in us. Maybe it's bone deep when we see a Ponderosa forest. There's something we recognize and really feel like we belong to.
I want to quote from the book. You say in many drier stretches of the region, talking about the Southwest, which is what you're talking about, only the Ponderosa has figured out how to thrive to the point of becoming a towering presence. Has an amazing ability to put down deep tap roots. You talk about how its needles, you know, close at certain areas. Talk about the kind of the physiology of the tree.
Yeah, it's actually four times more efficient as far as water loss than, say, a Douglas fir. So it regulates its water loss through the pores in the needles is where that happens with great efficiency. It's able to put down deep tap roots, as even seedlings have 2 foot deep tap roots, which is a lot. And then a mature tree might go 30, 35 feet down. So that prepares it, if you will, to live in some marginal places where other trees, other than pinyon and juniper, have really just not been able to figure it out. Being in a fire landscape, and it evolved with fire. Fire is its friend, as it is for most of the inland west and the vegetation that lives there. It has the habit of dropping its branches in the first 20 or 30 feet of the trunks, and that would keep fire from essentially climbing the ladder and getting into the crown of the tree and killing it. Its young tree seedlings can withstand temperatures of 150 degrees. It's a super tree, which makes it even more astonishing that through human-caused activity, we have pushed it not just to the brink, but in many places beyond it. There was a biological survey done not too long ago in the Rocky Mountains, and it was found that of the Ponderosa that burned in big fires in the last 30 years, only a third of them had not a single tree growing in them. So the conditions are such now, because again of what we've done and not done, that even this hardy survivor is really on the ropes.
I want to have you talk a little bit more about the Ponderosa in movies and art and in books. You mentioned the Ponderosa, the ranch,
yes,
right?
Yes,
long-running television series Bonanza. Tell me about other appearances of Ponderosa in art and movies, etc.
Yeah, you can imagine with the descriptions we've talked about here of this forest and how unique it is and how welcoming and how inspiring and awesome and how much stature it has, it would appeal to artists, and indeed it has. A lot of the Zane Grey novels, the Louis L'Amour novels, have Ponderosa as minor characters. Their outlaw characters are riding through Ponderosa woods. Filmmakers loved the Ponderosa. If Thelma and Louise, as they were flying off the edge of that cliff at the end of the movie, would have looked just to the left, they would have been looking at the La Salle Mountains and the Ponderosa forest. So I'm not sure they did that, but that could have been their last view. Easy Rider, you know, Peter Fonda's on his chopper riding across northern New Mexico past Ponderosa. And then you've got some very accomplished artists as well. D.H. Lawrence fell in love on a ranch near Taos with a specific Ponderosa that he would go and write under, and wrote some of his best material under, sleep on a bench and look up when he woke up in the middle of the night through the branches of those trees, or that tree. And then Georgia O'Keeffe did the same thing, and then was so inspired by that particular Ponderosa that she did a beautiful piece of art that's not like anything else she did, and I invite everyone to go online and find this. It's beautiful. It's an image called the Lawrence Tree, named after D.H. Lawrence, and it's very cosmic. It's modern and dynamic, and it's just something that really shines all these decades later. Ansel Adams came to northern New Mexico and did a lot of his work photographing ponderosa forests and ponderosa trees. So it really, really still calls to a lot of artists. It showed up in French calendars and German paintings, and all over the world. And I it's not mysterious to me why that happened, but it's still wonderful to see this chronology of all these often profound artists who found their inspiration in those groves.
Chapter two, I think it is, you take us back 10,000 years, and you've already said that maybe it's in our bones, right, that the ponderosa evolved along with humans. Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, as the Ice Age was coming to a close, let's say 12, 13, 14,000 years ago, ponderosa was limited to just basically some islands, if you will, of the trees in New Mexico, a couple in Arizona, and then there were some out near the Pacific. That was it. And it was just not welcoming to any further north. But as the Ice Age faded and conditions warmed and things dried out, ponderosa went on the march, and over thousands and thousands of years, bird by bird, carrying seed by seed, that tree moved northward until the Rocky Mountain version of ponderosa was well into Canada. Ultimately, the Pacific, the Sierra version was into Canada and Vancouver as well, east of the Cascades. And then they came together. Today, you can find both of those strains together in western Montana. So it was, again, it's kind of talking to its hardiness and its ability to take advantage of any opportunity it gets. It's a very patient tree, but when the conditions are right, it will do everything it can to take advantage of it. And the other interesting thing is when they go and collect seeds, which happens every year to try to create seedlings to replant fire scars, they're very careful to collect seeds only from the area where that burn happened, because ponderosa are so good at finely attuning themselves to whatever landscape they're living in that if you went to, say, the Sierras or some other place well to the north and got seeds and tried to plant them in Utah, they probably wouldn't do as well. So they're a master of aligning themselves with the reality of the conditions they live in.
You say that ponderosa were instrumental in the rise of the first cities thousands of years ago.
Yes, absolutely. The great multi-storied ancestral Pueblo villages that we find in southern Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, the roof structures, the beams, if you will, were made of ponderosa almost exclusively. In one site, Chaco Canyon, many of your listeners have probably been there, there were 250,000 ponderosa trees used for roof beams over the course of people living there. And the most amazing thing is none of those ponderosa grew closer than 40 miles away. So we're talking about people going out 40, sometimes 50 miles, selecting the trees, cutting them down, and then carrying them back 40 or 50 miles to use them that way. So yes, they became really what allowed, you might say, the first cities in what would later become the United States to rise. And then as people continued to live in that area, and probably well before, they used ponderosa for food. It's incredibly, the inner bark is rich in nutrients and minerals. They learned to make flour out of the inner bark. To this day, pine boughs from the ponderosa are used in sweat lodges in a lot of indigenous cultures because it is thought to increase clarity and give courage. So there's been this lovely relationship, not surprisingly, with the indigenous tribes since long before we can even see.
Let's take our first break, and we'll come back much more to talk about. We're talking about The Twilight Forest. It's the new book from Gary Ferguson, talking about the ponderosa pine. And before we go to break, Gary Ferguson, tell us again what estimates are. Mid-century, we'll have lost how many of these trees?
Yeah, we've already lost just in, I'd say, 25 years, about somewhere between 200 and 300 million ponderosa trees. And Some ecologists are predicting that by mid-century or shortly after, we may lose 90% of them in this region from the Southern Sierras to northern New Mexico through Utah. And so that's the current prediction. Some very astute scientists are now saying that maybe by the end of the century, most conifers in the Southwest will be gone, not just ponderosa, but others as well.
We'll talk about that, and we'll talk about why, right? It has to do with water, has to do with climate change, has to do with fire suppression, which are some central themes that we should talk about. We'll have more with Gary Ferguson following this break.
Utah Public Radio presents the Corner Concert Series, where we invite Utah-based musicians to our station to play for us. Our next episode features a punk rock band based in Logan, Utah, called The Jugs. Recorded in the corner of our studio, The Jugs are a blast of out-of-control drums, shredded guitar, and a vibe like no other. The Corner Concert Series, airing Friday the 6th, 10 a.m., and Saturday the 7th at 3 p.m. Or watch the concert recording later on UPR's YouTube channel and at upr.org.
Hi, this is Nick Forster. This week in E-Town, very exciting. We're welcoming back Ricky Lee Jones, along with French country singer now living in Texas, Theo Lawrence, plus my conversation with immigration attorney Diego Guevara. That's all this week in E-Town.
Tune in Saturday evening at 7 here on UPR.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in October of last year.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're pleased to welcome back to the program writer Gary Ferguson. He's author previously of The Carry Home and many other books. His new book is The Twilight Forest. And we're talking about the loss, which potentially be accelerating here, of the ponderosa, this ponderosa pine tree. Iconic and very useful in the ecology of many areas. We're talking about the Southwest region. So, Gary Ferguson, I'd like to get into talking about your personal connection with ponderosa pine. I'll start here. I was reading again your biography. You told your parents, apparently about 9 years old, you're gonna head west someday.
I did. Stuck back there in flat old northern Indiana. I told them I wanted to move west, and the reason I knew I did is because they had been in a drugstore with my brother and me, and often they would say, oh, if you guys want a comic book, go ahead and get one. And so I was standing in front of the magazine stand, and beside the comic books there was a magazine called Colorado Rocky Mountain West, and it was beautiful photos of the Rockies. And I bought that instead of a comic book, and the next day or two told them, yes, I was going to be moving west. When I was 13, I laid out a series of maps that connected South Bend to Colorado Springs, and I had all the road routes on it, and I announced to them I'd saved enough money from mowing lawns and shoveling snow that I was going to climb on my Sears 5-speed Stingray bike, and I was going to ride out to Colorado Springs, and not to worry because I would be back from what I could figure before school started. And much to my great shock and disappointment, they put the nix on that particular plan. But I did get out to the west and to the great forest and the mountains of the west as soon as possible.
The opening of the book, you started in Utah, the opening of the book. Yes. You're in southern Utah, I think. Yes. And you're involved in an exercise you say you do a lot. You're up in a high place and you're looking out over the twisted canyons, and that you tend to plot a course through those canyons looking for ponderosa.
Yeah, I love to get on some sort of high point, and there is no more, I would say, wizard-inspired, magical, mystical landscape that I've seen anywhere in the world than southern Utah. So I try to get on a high place, and I look out and then play this game where I imagine what would it be like to walk from where I am to this arbitrary location 20 or 30 miles away, and I find myself always linking my journey from Ponderosa Grove to Ponderosa Grove, because you can tell where Ponderosa are growing by their kind of dusky green branches against the landscape. Probably impossible to actually pull off, but nonetheless, those trees, I know how beautiful they are, and they would offer great respite on such an arduous journey. But they also increasingly would be what would save you from the sun eating you alive. And as our temperatures get higher, this is something I think about with all the backcountry travelers who I admire. When you're going through the Southwest, Ponderosa is a big part of how you stay safe, depending on where you are. And as those groves disappear, it's going to be a harder thing to be a hardscrabble traveler in some of those landscapes without the trees. And of course, the trees disappearing take a lot of other things with them. There are almost 250 species that forest community supports. So disappearing with them will be goshawks and white-headed woodpeckers and Mexican spotted owls and things like that. So it's not just the tree ever that disappears with a forest. It's all the things that depend on that forest for life. And some of them will just be displaced to other places, but their populations will probably shrink. And some may disappear.
So as the Ponderosa disappear, it'll be grasslands by and large. I guess some might say, well, what's wrong with that? How do you respond?
That's a fair point. Grasslands and shrublands. And there's a reason we can get into later why those particular plants are able to survive where Ponderosa can't. But there's nothing wrong with grass and shrublands. And yes, they store carbon and they can be very diverse and they support pollinators and all of those things. So it's not like we're going to a paved parking lot situation here by any means. But there are profound consequences both from loss of biodiversity that I just described with all the species that Ponderosa support. But also, and this is a big one, when you take away the Ponderosa forest, you're opening the land to earlier and quicker snowmelt. And so in the West, 65% of the fresh water flow comes from snowmelt. So if you take all the forest or a significant portion of the forest away, that snow is going to melt earlier. The fire seasons are going to get even longer. They're already 3 months longer than they were 30 years ago. So those kinds of effects are going to be in play as well with the loss of that forest.
I want to have you expand a little bit on how Ponderosa especially has helped you heal from personal loss. A quote from the book here. This is Gary Ferguson. Plenty of landscapes have thrilled me over the years. The summits of big mountains, the fast roiling bellies of Arctic rivers. But when the matter at hand was to salvage myself, nothing suited me like Ponderosa. Tell me about that.
Well, I think this goes back to what I mentioned earlier about those big losses that I suffered in my life with my father first, my mother, and then my first wife when she was 50. There's something about a Ponderosa forest, and if you haven't experienced, please go out and do it, that really offers a sense of belonging and a sense of welcoming and comfort. It's peaceful in a Ponderosa forest, but there's also a quiet sense that we've got you, you know, we've got you. We're holding you. You're part of us. We're part of you. Just rest easy. And all kinds of forests can inspire and satisfy me. But there's something about those Ponderosa forests, probably because of the stature of them and the spaciousness of them. And perhaps that wonderful butterscotch or vanilla perfume that really, really serves as a healing agent. You know, it's not any surprise. Lots and lots of physiological research has been done to show how when we're in nature, our cortisol levels go down, our blood pressure goes down, our heart rate. We get a lot of things that make us feel good in nature. So we're healthier. And so it's not all that surprising, but never has that phenomenon been more noticeable to me than when I'm in the woods, the Ponderosa forest.
Let's get into talking about why the Ponderosa are declining in rapid decline. Maybe we can start with fire suppression.
Yeah, in the early 20th century, a fledgling Forest Service made the decision that it was going to stake out its claim for legitimacy. And this was important because Congress, a lot of people in Congress thought, oh, here's just another pork barrel project that we don't really need to support. So the Forest Service went all in on we're going to be the fire suppression agency. And that's all well and good. But they took it to a remarkably unbelievable level looking back. At one point in 1934, the forest supervisor came up with what's called the 10 a.m. rule. And that was that any fire that breaks out in the West, we're going to have it extinguished by 10 o'clock the next morning. Now, that is a hallucination that would never, ever in any place in the West at any time be doable. It's just not. This is a fire landscape. The other thing, though, the big consequence was that by becoming so aggressive against every fire, even though there was plenty of opportunity to talk with indigenous people who'd been burning the land for years and others who said, no, you really do need to burn the land to keep it healthy. But the real consequence of not letting those fires burn is in the inland West, the only way practically that nutrients get back into the soil and keep the cycle going, the next flush of life going in a forest, is because the trees and the debris and the fallen trees burn and their nutrients are returned into the ashes. And that's where other plants get them, is from the ashes. We don't have the kind of microbial activity that wetter places like here in the Northwest or back in the East decompose. So it's fire. So if you stop fire altogether, and this is, by the way, it's important to realize that for thousands of years, fires, healthy fires, moved through the landscape about every 5 to 7 years. When I say healthy fires, I mean fires with probably 10 to 15 foot high flames, 1400 degree temperatures. Now we have 150, 200 foot flames, 2000 foot temperatures. 2000 degree temperatures. And the reason why is because all that debris from that excessive suppression started to build up, so that today we sit with 300 million acres of land that are under, you might say, unnaturally heavy fuel loads. That's three times as big as California. So the other thing I wanted to mention really quickly is, if you take fire not off the table, you also encourage this habit that a lot of forests have of young trees coming in bunched manner. So you've got a very crowded forest. Fires came through and actually limited the spacing of those young trees, took a lot of them out. Also, by the way, you know, limited insect infestation and other diseases and blights. But if you look at an acre, let's say just south of the Mogollon Rim in Arizona today, historically or before European contact, the mature ponderosa forest would have been growing at a rate of about 100 or 150 trees per acre. That same acre today might have 5,000 trees. So before we even talk about climate change, you've got super bunched forest, you've got heavy fuel loads, and so now the fires that we get are extraordinarily severe. And I'll probably mention this again with climate change, but when we have severe frequent fires, and the frequency is a climate change phenomena, then the land burns and burns and burns to the point where the ponderosa seedlings just finally are pushed out, and the grass and the shrubs, which keep their roots after a fire and can spring up quickly, they inherit the land. And then there's really not the opportunity a lot of times for trees to come back. So that suppression was a big deal, was a very, very big deal. And I'm sorry we didn't listen to so many of the indigenous people and quite a few scientists too, who tried to warn the agency that no, this is not what we need to do. But it would be in the 1970s before we really started to kind of scratch our head and go, wow, well, maybe occasional fires and let burn policies might be useful to keep the forest healthier.
Is that reversible at this point? Are we still going to lose that many ponderosa that's estimated?
Well, what's going on in a lot of the West, and certainly Utah and across the Southwest, as your listeners know, is prescribed burning. And prescribed burning is exactly meant to mimic those healthy fires that used to burn through every 5 to 7 years. Prescribed burning absolutely works. In fact, even when you get in big mega fires like the Dixie Fire, million acres out in California, the places in the forest that had been treated, if you want, by prescribed burns, fared way better. And they were the only forest that fared okay in that enormous inferno. So yes, it can help the forest regain some of its health. The problem, or a problem, is we need to be treating about 8 million acres annually, and some years are better years. We're managing to treat about 2 to 3. So there's a lot of work to be done. It takes human power. It takes budget, all of those things. And those are just not coming online nearly as fast as they should. So, yes. And then, to be honest, though, Tom, once a forest is gone altogether, the act of replanting it is quite difficult for reasons we can go into, if you'd like, as well.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that. It seems like, replanting that on that big a scale, I don't know, is that doable?
That's so hard. I mentioned how little percentage-wise of the prescribed burning we're actually achieving. We're replanting about 3% of what we need to do annually. Volunteers are going around in every state and collecting ponderosa seed from the area that they want to replant for the reasons I said earlier, because those seeds are tuned into that environment, and doing it to the tune of well over 1 million seeds a year. But in a big fire year, you could be looking at needing 180 to 200 million seeds. And of course, those seeds have to be grown into seedlings. And then those seedlings have to go out and be planted, and not necessarily just shoehorned into the ground and then you walk away and you're done. Some of those plantings have to be tended. They have to be done very carefully by people who know what they're doing. And so we're only managing about 3% of the replanting efforts that we need to be doing if we want to stand any chance of keeping some of these forests going. Doesn't mean that we're not achieving it, especially in certain national forests, out in the Sequoia National Forest. San Juan National Forest over in Colorado is doing their best. Dixie National Forest, Southern Utah, trying their best. But they're really operating under very strong constraints at this point, and it's just not an easy task to pull off. We go forward and do the best we can.
Tell me about water, about drought, especially in the Southwest. It's pretty severe. What does that do to the ponderosa forest?
Yeah, we're right now in the 32nd consecutive year of drought in the American Southwest, again, from the Southern Sierras all the way to New Mexico. Ponderosa are really drought resistant, so they're not newcomers or softies when it comes to surviving drought. But this is unprecedented drought, something not seen in as far as we know, at least 9,000 years. So what happens is, if you get too much drought, yes, the trees can actually die of thirst. That's a possibility. But far more often, they're just stressed to the point where insects, mistletoe, blight can come in and take them down. You know, when pine beetles show up, the typical healthy response of a tree, it's not always successful, but the healthy response is to literally, as that insect bores a hole in to lay its eggs under the bark, it exudes this pitch. So it pitches the insect out. Well, without enough moisture, there's no pitch available to be pitching out insects. So you have a huge mortality rate in drought. And then, of course, those trees, when they die, become massive fuel loads for the next climate change infused goose to fire that comes through. And so, yeah, water is a big deal. The other thing we mentioned earlier about how the crowding of the forest has happened because of fire suppression, well, that means less water per tree. You know, if you have 150 trees that are trying to get water in a mature ponderosa forest, there's a little bit more for everybody than if you've got 5,000 trees. So that plays into the drought situation as well. And I just think we are in long term, there'll be ups and downs, it'll be a roller coaster, but the trend is going to be to continue to stay very, very dry. And yet, I'm sorry to be repeating myself, but yet again, circles back to why it's important to have those forests sheltering the snowpack so that we've got water in the aquifers and in the freshwater flow streams and rivers.
The underlying factor here is climate change, right? Tell me about that and how that's affecting the ponderosa forests.
It is. I mean, the fire suppression was a huge mistake we're trying to make up for. But when fire suppression met climate change, and especially, I'd say, from the 90s on, then all bets were off. Wildfires started behaving so differently, doing things that firefighters had never seen before, especially around 2000, that they understood that they needed to sort of rewrite the playbook as far as how they were responding and fighting these fires because they were so much more severe. Climate change is real. We know it's real from a couple reasons. One is when you go up into the atmosphere and sample carbon, you can tell which of the carbon was created by fossil fuels and which was not. The fossil fuels have very little carbon 14 for reasons we don't need to get into. But so it's actually possible to go and say, yeah, well, this much of the atmosphere has been changed by human activity. The other thing I'd say is when you do computer modeling, and let's say you tell the computer to mimic what's going on right now, let's say in the American West, the Southwest, you cannot get the computer to generate a replica without factoring in a significant part of the human component of that. So it's real. And we have the technology, arguably, to do a lot about it. You know, we can really make headway. But whether we have the heart and whether we have the will remains to be seen.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with the final segment with Gary Ferguson. We're talking about his new book. It's out and available now. It's called The Twilight Forest. Subtitle is An Elegy for Ponderosa in a Changing West. And we'll have more following this break.
Programming support here on Utah Public Radio comes from our members and the Cache Valley Chamber of Commerce, presenting the 2025 Awards Gala Thursday, March 26th at the Riverwoods Conference Center. Tickets available at cachechamber.com. And support for UPR also comes from the USU Office of Global Engagement, sending USU students to high-impact learning experiences in South America, Europe, Asia, and Australia. Learn more about programs at studyabroad.usu.edu.
Next on the Putumayo World Music Hour,
we'll hear some of the exciting voices that are helping to introduce Latin music to mainstream audiences. I'm Dan Storper.
And I'm Rosalie Howard. Join us for Radio Latino, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us Thursday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in October of last year.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with writer Gary Ferguson, and we're talking about his new book, which is called The Twilight Forest, an elegy for Ponderosa in a Changing West. I want to talk about a feeling of loss. Many people mourn not only Ponderosa, but their favorite species maybe that's disappearing in this time of great change. I want to quote you, quoting the poet Jane Hirschfield. Mm. She said years ago, to mark the death of one of her favorite old trees, today for some, a universe has vanished. Profound quote, just one tree, right? And then we're talking about a huge forest. I want to quote you from the book. This is Gary Ferguson. Like a lot of people, in more anxious moments, I find myself just wanting to escape, forget it all for a while. But sooner or later, I always come back to the urge to pick even one of these thousand doors of loss, pull it open, and walk through. Tell me about that. And what's your advice to people?
Yeah, it's so, I don't have to tell any of your listeners, it's so easy to be overwhelmed by the scope of the loss, the variety of the loss. I personally find it useful to pick one thing that has a great deal of meaning to me in the Ponderosa Forest is certainly, it qualifies for that. And then just walk right into the situation, right into the loss. See if there are opportunities you can join with other people to do things to make the loss less severe. But nonetheless, embrace that to the point that you enter, yes, grief. You're going to end up to some degree grieving the loss, and you're grieving it because you are coming into relationship, deep relationship with something you care about. So this is the good news. When you walk through that grief and when you embrace it and you hold it, you also light up this part in yourself that allows you to really be thankful for the kind of kinship that's within you, that you can intuit, that you can sense. This is some of the work that Mary and I do with Full Ecology. So, yeah, you're going to have some sadness in this embracing of one particular loss, but you're also going to open yourself up to the kind of energy through that kinship that will keep you going and keep you able to serve the planet and your fellow humans for a long time to come. Tom, sometimes I talk about how we need new, and I did in this book as well, we need new stories. We need new metaphors. And what I'm talking about is a culture behaves according to the stories it has. Now, some of them may be very much subconscious at this point. But one category of story we've become uber fond of in the last 400 years since Enlightenment science is this notion of things being separate, pieces and parts. Descartes, Francis Bacon, Newton believed that the universe was really, they used the analogy of a watch. You know, it's just a watch. It's made of these pieces and parts. You take it apart. This is why Descartes was said to occasionally resort to terrible stunts like kicking his dog during lectures, and the dog would yelp, and Descartes would be able to say, now I know it looks like I hurt the dog, but I didn't, because animals are not able to feel pain. Or feel emotion. And so this disconnection of the world into pieces and parts was a great delusion. And then it yielded, in this country especially, this notion of the rugged individual. There is no rugged individual on planet Earth, and probably well beyond. But it doesn't exist, because the pieces and the parts aren't the thing that make life happen and evolve and become the leading edge. It's the relationship of those pieces and the parts that give creative capacity to nature. And we're part of nature, so creative capacity to us as well. And so I think if we can just even start looking, you know, sometimes I tell people a little exercise, and I'll say it now if we've got a moment. And that is to ask yourself, do you end at the edge of your skin? This is something Mary and I do a lot with people with Full Ecology. Do you end at the edge of your skin? And if you start investigating it, you know, you've got more microbial organisms in you than you do human cells. And they didn't come in with you at birth. They've come to live with you since then. And they digest the food you eat and release the nutrients. You've got microbes on your skin that keep pathogens out. When you walk under trees, the trees aren't just giving you oxygen. They're giving you phytoncides, which is a class of chemicals that allow you to have a fortified immune system and strengthen your vital organs. The sun every day is setting your melatonin and other levels of different hormones. So you're connected and you're in relationship. And if that wasn't the case, you would not be here. And so to the extent we can really celebrate this, and I think a forest is a wonderful way to celebrate it, to be honest, because yes, there are all these very strong, unique individuals, without question, no two trees are alike. And also those trees reach their potential because they're part of a larger supportive community. And that's not a bad model to start thinking about. And just put down the rugged individual stuff. It's fine. You know, you can stand out as an individual and live your best life, but it doesn't mean that that life isn't supported and heartened by a lot of other relationships that are close by.
Some say that individuals making small choices to combat climate change doesn't matter, not going to have a big effect. You push back pretty strongly on this. Tell me about this.
Yeah, that's really a terrible but popular thing among a lot of people, a lot of progressives, a lot of environmentally friendly people. They're just kind of throwing their hands up and walking into cynicism or hopelessness by virtue of asking the question, what difference does it make? I'm just a lone individual. Well, I will repeat what Bill McKibben always says to that. And he says, stop acting like a lone individual. Come together. There are always groups of people doing the things that you think could be done, maybe should be done, to support and serve and maybe even save different parts of the natural world. So come together. The other thing is, yes, if you measure just the effect of what you do through the day, the decisions you make, it may seem like a drop, but the ocean is made of a lot of drops. And the more people stand by their decisions on a daily basis, the better. And the other thing that I would suggest is, even if it's all for nothing, okay, and we're all gone in 100 years, this living in a way as if the earth matters, as if nature matters, as if, oh, I'm not going to waste this water because water is precious. That kind of sensibility keeps bringing you into kinship. It brings you into kinship, and that's a happier, more heart-filled place to live. It's not an illusion. It's actually quite a movement toward a deeper reality than what we've been living under for quite some time.
Well, we've reached the end of the program. I guess just finally, you'll probably be out soon seeking out a Ponderosa for us.
Yes, I will, as a matter of fact. Yes, heading down back to the southwest in a couple weeks and stopping in the Flagstaff area, the biggest ponderosa forest in the world, and paying my respects, definitely.
Well, it's a wonderful book, The Twilight Forest, An Elegy for Ponderosa in a Changing West. We've been talking with the author, Gary Ferguson. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. My pleasure.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
Skywatcher Leo T here, where it's one sky, many cultures. We don't just watch the night skies, but the day skies as well, don't we? And just before 9 a.m. as I arrived home on the 2nd of March, I looked up at our neighbor's very tall spruce tree, and there sat at the top a possibly wet, fluffed out, brown and white hawk, which our neighborhood consensus is to be a Cooper's hawk, albeit a very large one, and near the hawk was an orange robin singing on another high branch. The hawk eventually took off with a large flap or two, but the robin comes back every evening to sing its melodic and comforting song at sunset. Kirsten, being an excellent photographer, framed up some great photos of our visitor, and I'll post one on the Skywatcher Facebook page. My partner also possibly the same hawk she saw the rainy day before, 15 feet away in our little yard. You can also see this photo from where the birds come, including the blue jays, sparrows, and red house finches, and wintry towhees with their orange, black, and white plumage. Fast forward a bit to early morning the next day, the 3rd of March, when the full moon eclipse started around 3 in the morning, and in totality for about an hour. Cloudy and rainy here, but great reports of this come in from an astronomer at Natural Bridges National Park. Fantastic, she said. At any rate, the very full-looking moon came up again the next evening above the Red Butte and the Wasatch, and it was seen by our neighbor's friend. So we went out to have a look at the marvelous big Luna with its craters, peaks, and mares all showing great relief, and watched it get higher and move across the sky during the night. Also look for some knocked-out photos of the moon from Kirsten Hepburn on the Skywatcher Leo T Facebook page as well. Eclipse or not, it's amazing to see our closest celestial neighbor in all its glory. Also, poet and friend Margaret Pettis has many poems that intertwine earth and sky, and this one of hers is called Shadow Speak.
We run from the moon on the far side of alder and elm, picket and clothesline, etching inky lines crisscrossed by deer and night-roving hounds. Yin to the yang of harsh light after midnight, we are as bold as the mirror of the sun, sketching our labyrinth of black branches on new snow below. Silver on an owl's back, the moon's camouflage, beneath silver wings we ride in the hunt, under limp leaves, mice quiver in our clutch. Into the night of stars, sprinkled wide, clouds skim the peaks, roam south like our sheep. The moon disappears.
Thank you, Margaret. When Margaret is not writing poetry, she is navigating wetlands and waterways in her kayak in northern Utah and many other adventures. As this is Women's History Month, we'll be featuring poems from women all month, which we do here anyway. Today, this one is from poet Tina Thomas, or Teninja.
The mysterious mentor, always changing, moving, contemplated but never touched, unseen, hiding in slot canyons and in a ray of early evening sunlight that touches a pink old-fashioned rose. It is time that has woven our souls together, thread by thread, memories and possibilities intertwined. Our connection to each other is an entity unto itself, an energy that transcends our physical selves and that travels on the delicate breeze, in lightning, and to the secret places where birds go.
So look up, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space and time. Skywatcher Leo T.